Welcome. This is William Evans, and you're listening to Shifting Gears. Our guest today is Tyler Lindsay. This is the second in a series of conversations with Tyler, and it's an exploration of our relationship with water and what a number of researchers and writers have called the flow state. We were ending our last conversation, Tyler, and you were bringing in the issue of collapse and contrasting it with what were isolated episodes of collapse involving Greece and Rome and Babylonia, and here in North America, Chaco Canyon. And we noted that the exception of Chaco Canyon was that they reinvented themselves as the Pueblo people who continue today along the Rio Grande and at Hopi Mesa. Have you had any reflections on that conversation since we talked and things you'd like to add?
Where we left off was in this notion that the Hopi people were able to move to new territory in order to continue surviving.
And the critical element was water.
Yeah, the place that they were living got too dry to maintain the agricultural practices that had sustained them and allowed them to grow and thrive. And I assume that while a non-trivial number of them were able to leave and go find a new watershed at the Rio Grande, that probably a lot of them did not survive.
Well, the Hopi actually went to the edge of a mesa south and a little west of Chaco Canyon, and probably the majority of people, there were a variety of tribes that I think came together at Chaco, but the majority went to the Rio Grande drainage.
Mm-hmm.
And it's an interesting place to start this conversation today because, once again, water could be the decisive element and relationship in our future, but not just in a local way, but in a planetary way.
That's right, yeah. So one of the ideas that that we talked about last time is this notion that the ability of a civilization to pass through this sort of crisis and go on to thrive is the exception rather than the common outcome.
And it requires a sense of balance and the ability to recover balance. What else does it require?
It requires creativity to invent new ways of being.
And I would suggest there's another very important component. And I had this experience with a high school class at Roaring Fork High School, and I asked them a question. I said, how many of you think humanity's going to make it? And they shut down.
Mm.
And I contacted an indigenous friend and I said, Woody, I've got myself in this situation. What suggestions do you have? And he said, tell them this is not the first time humanity's faced a calamity. And our experience, he's a history keeper of the Haida Nation up on the Northwest Coast.
Okay.
He said, people who are able to cooperate are more likely to survive. And it was interesting in the second class to come back and start that way, but also have to acknowledge that in a competitive contest behavior culture, easy to say cooperation, it doesn't happen so easily.
The thing that popped into my mind as I was listening to you is this book by a historian sociologist named James Carse. and it's called Finite and Infinite Games. I don't know if you're familiar with it.
I'm not.
It's a very slim book, simple language, but really dense in ideas.
Right.
And so, you know, broadly, Karst draws a contrast between finite games. These are games with a discrete rule set where there are winners and losers and a measurement of winning and losing. And when the criteria for winning or losing have been achieved, the game ends. So this is a finite game. An infinite game is a game where the purpose of the game is to keep the game going. And rather than being a competitive game, it becomes a collaborative game. And so, you know, instead of a football game where the criteria is at the end of these four quarters of play, the team that has moved the ball across the line the most times is the winner.
Right.
This might be something like an imagination game that children would play where, you know, as the game evolves, it becomes more complex and new things are added, and you have to have a sense of openness to the new things that your playing partner is introducing in order to build upon them and continue the game.
But the critical concept I heard was that it's non-contest play. It's real play.
Right. It's a So the biggest difference between a finite game, which has winners and losers, and an infinite game, is that if the game doesn't end, winners and losers are not a thing.
And
there are just players.
And playing is a lot of fun.
It is that, yeah.
And it's really more fun than a contest and trying to be a winner and make everybody else a loser.
Yes, and also, when a win-lose game is played with enough iterations, eventually each round of a win-lose game tends to escalate in terms of the ferocity of the game. And so, you know, going back to American football as an example of a win-lose game, as the players get larger and larger, the violence of the game also grows to the point where even if you win the Super Bowl, you lose because you have so many head injuries that you can't live the full length of your natural life.
Yeah, and you never achieve wisdom because you've beaten your brains out.
Right. So these win-lose games over enough rounds of the game become they transition from win-lose to lose-lose.
Well, and, you know, we seem to be pushing up in that direction on a planetary scale.
It feels that way, doesn't it?
And so how can you help us from your age and your inherent, what I read, optimism over the course of our acquaintance over probably 15 years, your optimism deal with the issues we're dealing with, and we're going to hold it to water and what's happening to the water. And I'll just throw out two things that have happened to water in my lifetime.
Okay.
The pH has changed, so we
in
now.
Which direction? In which direction has it changed?
It's acidic.
Mm.
So we have acid rain falling into mountain lakes up here, above us, and we have an acidification of the ocean that's changing the coral.
Mm.
The other thing that has happened is that, as a result of our experiment with plastics, our rivers have become estrogenic.
Hmm.
Because plastic is an endocrine mimicking creation of man that has an estrogenic component. So tell me how you can gather your colleagues of your age and come up with a solution, because I know you're optimistic and you see the possibility of growth. To me, it seems like a huge educational challenge, but tell me what you see.
This is going to sound like a funny answer. I think we need to get into space and become a space-faring civilization as quickly as possible.
A space-faring
civilization.
Faring.
We need to, this is largely Elon Musk's big idea, which is that it's going to take us a while to transition from these win-lose games to these win-win games. It's hard for me to imagine a growth in human wisdom that will enable that. But getting more of our resources from space will go a long way to easing that resource pressure that we're finding ourselves in, to give us a longer window to make that transition to where, you know, broadly speaking, we should move any dirty, dangerous industrial processes off planet so that we can allow the natural processes of the Earth to rejuvenate and Earth should be a giant nature preserve, and all of our, synthetic biological engineering and nanotech replicator machines and, heavy duty mineral mining for, these rare earth minerals that run our cell phones, all that stuff should move off planet.
Do you know anybody who'd be willing to have our toxicity move to their territory?
Well, I think that's what is attractive about it, is to our knowledge, there's no one out there.
But that's an assumption.
Sure. I mean, but we've spent a lot of time looking at asteroids. And again, long term, a quieter, more peaceful, more low scale, low intensity ancestral lifestyle is obviously desirable. Well, but I don't see that as feasible for a planet of 8 billion people.
Nor do I. I would have to tell you, I think you're an illusion.
I may well be. Sure, I'm open to that.
I think that the possibility of a large-scale die-off here is real.
Oh, I don't deny that.
And I think that, there will be cultures, and there are cultures that will survive that purification. But I can't imagine that solution manifesting practically, but we'll wait and see.
Indeed, yeah. And so a couple sort of notes on collapse.
This is KDNK. You're listening to a conversation with Tyler Lindsay. We're talking about water quality and the current condition of the planet.
We're getting pretty out there. So there's this science fiction writer, William Gibson, who I really admire. And he's probably a lot less optimistic than I am about our prospects. But he has this wonderful phrase, which is, the future is already here. It's just not evenly distributed yet. And
what do you understand yourself and from him to be the future?
Well, let me paraphrase his statement and say, the collapse is also already here.
Yeah.
It's just not evenly distributed yet.
I think that's probably true.
One of my favorite public intellectuals is this guy, Vinay Gupta, and he has a talk from 2010 that I often return to as kind of a North Star to guide, the broad themes of my thinking. And he says, in a rich world Western context, collapse means living like the people that grow your coffee. And, the reality is that roughly a third of the human population of the planet lives in a subsistence agricultural context, largely around the equator. And that equator zone is becoming less and less inhabitable due to overheating and climate change. So, you know, for example, there's a city in India, Chennai, with roughly 5 million people. They're out of water, and it's been 50 degrees Celsius for the last month.
Talk about dehydration.
Right.
Let's calm down here and talk about hydration for a while, Tyler.
Yeah. I'm probably becoming dehydrated, which is why my ideas are getting so far out.
What have you learned over the course of your life about the value of hydration?
Well, I think you said it really well in the last episode when you said hydration enables vibration. You need to, you know, hydration is the lubricant of biological process. And absent a fluidity, the molecules of life can't move enough to enable life.
There's no flow.
There's no flow. So, yeah, I mean, drinking water is obviously critical. And
just water is enough.
Well said. Yeah, you know, so this is something that comes up a lot in my world of snowboarding, because, you know, the modern iteration of skiing and snowboarding in the terrain parks, there's a bike equivalent in the bike park. The X Games is just wrapping up in Minneapolis right now, and, you know, these young superhumans are performing maneuvers that have never been seen before, and really you know, extending the envelope of what we humans view as possible for our bodies. And there's this deep irony in that most of the funding for those practices comes from energy drink and soda manufacturers. And so
they just pour a lot of sugar into your water.
And they pour a lot of money into my sports.
And we watch the growing obesity.
Yeah, and diabetes and hypertension. And, you know, there's a tremendous amount of evidence that you become more susceptible to mental illnesses like this epidemic of depression that we see. So anyway, some dear friends of mine started a brand called Drink Water.
Good for them.
And it's very simple. Their logo is just a black and white tap and the words "drink water" in block letters. And it does a couple things. One, it's a friendly reminder to drink water, which I think we could all use. Certainly, I feel like I've spent a significant portion of my life in a state of chronic dehydration, you know, especially living in the arid West and doing these sports as I do. That's an easy thing for me to forget, to drink water. But then the other thing that it does that I think is really valuable is for these kids who engage in the outdoor athleticism of action sports, it gives them a target for tribal identification that is not only much healthier for them, but it also has a lot less unintended consequences for other people. Or, you know, to use the economics term, it has a lot less negative externalities.
Yeah, unanticipated negative consequences.
Right.
Adverse consequences. And I want to kind of head in that direction, but I want to travel with a level of awareness and identity that we haven't brought in here.
Mm.
Are you familiar with what a keystone species is?
Yeah, but only in the crudest terms.
Well, the indigenous people had a great respect for them. The scientists rediscovered their importance when they introduced wolves back into Yellowstone.
That's a wonderful case study. Yeah, and tell me that again.
And the wolves are the archetypical communal social keystone species, the pack. And they would prey on the elk herd and take down the unprotected young and the infirm, keep the herd and the genome healthy, and allow the habitat around the river to not get eaten down so much. So a whole variety of plants and birds and creatures move back in that couldn't do that before.
And it had this cascade of effects that literally changed the flow of the river.
It literally did, and it had an effect on what's called the trophic cascade. And in that sense, trophic cascade means the nutrient cycle. What was available to eat for everybody, including the elk who could be lazy and just eat the willows all year, they had to get out and find other things to find the nourishment they needed.
Mm. So it had a forcing function that drove both diversity and robustness or anti-fragility.
Yeah, it benefited a whole community. So to look at it from the other direction, if you take out a keystone species, you get a simplification, you lose the diversity, and you get a collapse,
mm-hmm.
an ecosystem collapse. And so it was very interesting as I got excited about learning about keystone species. I talked to some of the scientists who were key in this, and I asked the question, I said, are humans keystone species? Do we have that capacity?
Mm.
And without exception, the answer was no.
Mm-hmm.
I've seen too much of human, basically, foolishness, and I don't see evidence that there's a keystone species out there on two legs.
Mm-hmm.
When I'd ask my indigenous friends, they were rich with stories. And you realize that's how these people lived. So is there a way you can use your communication to awaken young people to the potential within them to be keystone species in relation to life and water?
I think there are a number of emerging techniques and technologies for that. When you are talking about these indigenous societies, one of the things that I keep coming back to is this notion that these are pretty small-scale societies. There's this concept, Dunbar's number. I don't know if you're familiar with it.
No, tell me about it.
So Robin Dunbar was a British sociologist, and he made the observation that primate tribal societies very rarely, that there's an upper limit on average for primate tribal societies. So in a baboon troop, for example, if you see a baboon troop grow much larger than about 100 individuals, it ends up splitting. And in human societies, Dunbar's number appears to be around 150. This is the maximum number of deep relationships that a human brain is capable of maintaining, a rich sense of.
A rich sense of?
Yeah. So it's possible to have a deep relationship with probably not more than 150 or so individuals. And when you get beyond that, a leader in such a society has a harder and harder time in understanding the people in the society, and this creates open space where social fracturing can occur. And so, you know, one of the sort of like threads that runs through the story of human civilization is this idea of technologies for social organization that allow us to escape the constraint of Dunbar's number. Probably the most effective of those organizational strategies to date has been a hierarchy built around a shared social fiction, as Yuval Noah Harari would put it.
A shared social fiction.
Correct. Yeah. So like religion would be an example of that humans have and can organize around to enable a greater scaling of human organization than was possible absent that story.
Interesting that you say that, because Thomas Berry says we're in between stories.
Mm.
Our old story doesn't work, and we don't really have the new story. Thanks, Tyler. Appreciate your coming to visit.
So maybe
it would be nice to have you come back again.
It would be my pleasure. Yeah, I mean, this is fun.
This is KDNK. We've been speaking with Tyler Lindsay about water and the consequences of human behavior. Thank you for listening.